Last weekend on Super Bowl weekend, I had a chance to have a brief chat with my next guest. His name is Lee Steinberg. He is arguably the most famous sports agent in history because the movie Jerry Maguire, if not based on him, certainly used a lot of input from him because he was an advisor to Cameron Crowe in putting together the script for that movie and for a lot of the stuff that happened to Tom Cruise's character in that movie. Now Lee Steinberg has written a book about his life called The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game, and I'm happy to have him back on the show today. Hi, Lee. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Good morning.
First story we've got to talk about is the breaking news over the weekend of Michael Sam, the Mizzou defensive end, who came out to his team last August but kind of kept it quiet, and the media in Missouri helped him keep it quiet so that it did not become a public matter last summer. But now that he is getting ready to go to the NFL Combine and then to the draft in a couple of months and then hopefully on to an NFL career, he made the announcement publicly yesterday. As an agent, tell me what you think the impact of this will be.
I think that football is more than ready to accept someone's sexual orientation as being different from theirs. This is a new generation. Those players under 30 and people in that generation are much more tolerant, much more live and let live. And the questions he ultimately will be asked is he a great practice player? Can he stuff the run? Can he rush the passer? Sports really is quite accepting if you think about it. You have a series of different races working together in harmony. That's not an issue. And I think that this is a very dramatic event, but after it passes, there'll be many more, and we'll come back to remember, as I remember, the 50s when there were no blacks or women on sports television or in locker rooms. They won't remember any differently.
Michael Sam was the SEC Defensive Player of the Year. He led the league in sacks and tackles for loss. He was considered somebody who would probably be a second or a third or maybe fourth rounder. What does this announcement do to him for his potential monetary prospects going forward?
I think it probably enhances them. He probably has a whole audience off the field, a subgroup that will be major fans and want to buy products he endorses. As to his draft prospects, my 40 years in representing athletes tells me that the only relevant criteria in this meritocracy, which is pro football, is can you perform, can you help us win? And again, if you imagine that the President of the United States has come out and supported gay marriage, and we had as rapid a change in social attitudes as I can ever remember on an issue, I think the press will make more of this than the players will.
What about management? Do we need a Branch Rickey kind of GM to make this move, to be the first to hire somebody who's out?
Depends how good the player is. If he's good enough, I don't think it's an impediment. I mean, we have players who've been to jail. We have players who've, you know, committed domestic violence. I mean, please.
Yeah.
This is hardly a choir school.
Yeah, this is the league of Ray Lewis and Aaron Hernandez and Michael Vick, after all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it'll be just fine. Again, it will be a major press issue, and some of that press is being done and ridden by people who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. That is not the same perspective that younger people have.
I read one thing this morning that said, why does anybody think that Michael Sam will succeed when Jason Collins came out after the last NBA season last year and announced that he was gay, and no team has hired him? But when I heard that, Lee, the first thing I thought was, Jason Collins is 32 years old and his career was pretty much over, right?
Thank you. Jason Collins, arguably, with or without any revelation, was probably not going to get signed again. This is a young SEC Defensive Player of the Year who was All-American, who's a great prospect. If you listen to his interview, he's mature, he's able to handle it, He'll fit in with teammates. He fit in with teammates at Missouri.
Yep.
You don't magically change the composition of the players who play football just because they go up a level.
Yep. You mentioned maturity. There is a maturity problem with some guys in the NFL. And yes, I'm talking about you, Richie Incognito. What do you think happens in a locker room? It only takes one incognito kind of guy to spoil this.
You know, the players have a very different take on this, Paul, honestly, which is that there is an internal mechanism in locker rooms to solve problems. And for someone to go outside of that, it brings into question a whole series of how men interact when they're by themselves that probably would not look good in public, whether it's in a locker room, whether it's in a fraternity. We need to get more real about this. No one condones racial prejudice, but when it comes to the rest of it, they had 1,000 tweets or texts between them.
Yeah.
It's hardly indicative of a one-way relationship.
On the other side of the fence, the management side, you've got the story that Chris Cluey told, the guy who was the punter for the Minnesota Vikings, saying he was essentially squeezed out of that because he was out there promoting marriage equality. And special teams coordinator Mike Prefer, Cluey wrote, said on multiple occasions that I would wind up burning in hell with the gays and that the only truth was Jesus Christ and the Bible, and he went on and on and on. So this issue of homosexuality and sports has crossed over a lot in the last 12 months or so, particularly with the Chris Cluey case and before that the case with Brendan Ayamadejo in Baltimore.
I think that you need to make a distinction between the way that conservative Christians view homosexuality, which is that it's against the Bible, and the way they treat individual people, because they're very careful to say love the sinner. I don't think they're sinners, but love the person. So I think they'll make a distinction here between their own faith and belief and tolerance for someone else in an interpersonal way.
What do you say to those who say this is all going to be a distraction and teams don't like distraction?
It's a press distraction. The players won't find it a distraction.
Yeah, I don't think the Mizzou Tigers considered it a distraction. They went 12-2 and won the Cotton Bowl.
Exactly.
Yeah. Talking with Lee Steinberg, his autobiography is out now. It's called The Agent. It talks about his 40-year career making deals that changed the game. Let's talk about something similar that you had to go through with one of your clients in the late 70s. You represented Warren Moon at a time when African-Americans were considered unable to play quarterback in the NFL. Now, I remember being in Washington, D.C., at the time that Doug Williams became the first black quarterback to take a team to the Super Bowl, and of course the Redskins won with his arm and legs behind them. But you were there even before that, a decade earlier, with Warren when it was even tougher. So how did you handle that, and how did he handle it?
Well, it shows you how much things have changed in 35 years, because at that point there was a presumption shared in some, not all, circles that the so-called middle positions in football, the quarterback, the middle linebacker, the center, and the safety, were thinking positions that ought to be played by whites. Warren went to Canada for 6 years, proved himself, and came back with three leagues competing against him and signed the largest NFL contract for a veteran to that time, and went on and played 17 years in the NFL. And I had the pleasure of presenting him at the Hall of Fame for his induction. And I think he broke a lot of barriers. But this is what I'm saying about gayness or anything else. These things change, and years later, you don't even remember that they ever were there.
Yeah. I mean, look who just won the Super Bowl.
There you go.
Yeah. But when you were dealing with that with Warren, those 6 years, he kind of was shunted aside to Canada as his agent. Did you tell him every year, okay, it's still not time? Or how did you handle that?
No, it was a matter of trying to do the timing correctly. As it was, the fact that he got the 6 years in Canada allowed him to come back at the confluence of the CFL, NFL, and USFL. So it was a three-way bidding war, and he came back just at the right time because he had peaked. and they could do for the first time in football what they'd never done before, which is just add a great mature player at the most critical position without giving up anything. So the dollars were astronomical.
I was glad to have that happen and set a precedent perhaps for what goes forward with other people who need to break barriers, and maybe Michael Sam will be that next person to do that. Let's talk about some of the people who are on the other side of the table when you sat down to negotiate with them, or maybe you did it over the phone, I don't know, the owners and the GMs. Who did you like negotiating with, and who was a pain in the butt?
Well, I make the point in the book that Mike Brown of the Bengals was my particular nemesis, that I had the first-round draft pick of the Bengals in 1987, 1992, 1994, 1995, and 1999, and if I'd represented astronauts, he'd been the commissioner of the moon. I loved negotiating with Carmen Policy, with the 49ers, who liked players and put together a great roster. I loved negotiating with Jerry Jones and Bob Kraft. These are two men that did a lot to spur the current success of the NFL, and they were big picture people. The thing about an owner is if you deal with him, he can make that decision instantly, which can be great or it can be disastrous, because they don't have to go to anyone. They just use their common sense. But it's a much more stimulating discussion, because you're not dealing with someone who's afraid of the reaction of someone above them.
Yeah, when he's the guy whose signature actually goes on the check, it's a lot easier, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. In the book, you refer to Jerry Jones as a visionary owner. What put him so far ahead of the others?
Because he understood that pro football was an entertainment, and that if done correctly and he charted his own course, which I pushed him to do, he could be extremely creative, not be bound by what other owners were doing. And whether it was Dallas Cowboy Travel Agency or Dallas Cowboy Cheerleader or cross ambushing Pepsi with Coke or vice versa, he could do all those things that expanded the parameters. He learned how to use social media. He learned how to do a series of things like that.
While we're in the world of the NFL, and particularly in Dallas, I've got to ask about Troy Aikman. You've got a chapter in the book, chapter 12, entitled Ticking Time Bomb, in which you talk about Troy Aikman going down and getting hit hard, and seeing him lying on the turf really changed your mind about football, didn't it?
I had a crisis of conscience, because it became clear to me that something was wrong and deleterious about players getting hit in the head, and we'd go to doctors that couldn't really tell us how many were too many. So I held a series of concussion conferences in the 90s, made sure that the players got to talk to neurologists. Not much changed. We did it again in 2007, and then neurologists told us that three or more concussions occasioned an exponentially higher rate of Alzheimer's, premature senility, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. I called it a ticking time bomb and an undiagnosed health epidemic. And now I believe that every time a lineman hits a lineman at the inception of a play, it produces a low-level subconcussive event, which means that an offensive lineman could come out of football with 10,000 subconcussive hits, not one of which had been diagnosed, all of which add up to a much worse damage on the brain than three hits does. So it's sort of an existential threat to football that they need to move urgently on.
When you saw Troy Aikman with blood leaking out of his ear and you knew something was wrong, that was 1989, and it has been a long time. You had these concussion conferences in the 1990s. Here we are in 2014, and really the discussion about the impact of concussions has only come to the fore in the last 12 to 18 months. Was the NFL covering it up?
Yes. They were running all sorts of studies that were clear that they that they knew there was damage occurring, and at that time the league lead physician, L.A. Pellman, was denying it all to the players. And when I raised the issue, he called me a fearmonger in Sports Illustrated. So they knew, they covered it up, they never could have gone to court on this lawsuit. And now we need new helmetry, we need new nutraceuticals and pharmaceuticals that can cure brain damage. We need better diagnostic techniques on the sidelines. It's and we need to move urgently.
You must cringe every time you watch a game and you hear an announcer say, "Well, he really got his bell rung," and they treat it almost as if it's a highlight.
Well, it was worse when they had two helmets hitting together.
Yeah.
At the start of Monday Night Football.
That's right. That's right. This is, I think, one of the things that really has to be dealt with going forward, and I think that the NFL, with that $765 million settlement they made last summer, which was recently thrown out by a judge saying this is not going to be enough to cover the players who it's supposed to cover, this is an issue that is going to continue to fester until they get it right.
That's true.
As an agent, when you are dealing with these guys and they're suffering from concussions and CTE and other head trauma, what can you do?
Try to use the parents, try to use the wife, try to use any resource with players who are in denial to make sure that they're logging the concussions, that we keep players out of the field of play when they've been concussed at a lower level. Try to get them to make sure not to play the week after they played the last time. But it's a hard battle because this is not coaches forcing players into playing. The players want to play. They're in denial.
Yeah, they want to get back out there. And what impact do you think that's having on people starting in football as young as 8 years old?
Well, suppose mothers know what I'm saying about the danger and tell their kids, you can play any sport but not tackle football. It won't kill football. It'll just change the socioeconomics of it so the same people will play it that currently box.
Before I let you go, I would not be doing my job here in St. Louis if I didn't ask about your relationship to Georgia Frontier, the late owner of the Los Angeles Rams turned St. Louis Rams.
I loved her. She actually threw a banquet for me for the Anti-Defamation League, where she was dinner host, where it was the first interracial banquet after the Watts riots, where I was man of the year. And I used to sit in her luxury box at Anaheim Stadium. I opposed the move of the Rams to St. Louis for the same reason I would have opposed the move from the Cardinals to Phoenix, which is I don't see ripping a team out of the bosom of fans who have supported it forever. This whole thing went wrong when St. Louis lost its team, and in 95, when expansion came, they gave the teams to Jacksonville and Carolina instead of giving St. Louis a new franchise. Then they would have had a franchise, not been in a position to take our franchise, and it would have been happy for everyone.
You know, there's talk now about Stan Kroenke, the current owner of the Rams, potentially moving the Rams back to Los Angeles.
Same problem, because once you tell fans that a team is their team and they should support them in loss, then how do you justify taking the team out of there?
But L.A. doesn't even support the teams that are there. They didn't sell out Rams and Raiders games, did they?
That's really a mischaracterization from this standpoint. The Rams sold out for 40 years. And at the very end, the Frontieri John Shaw reign wanted to move the team for a big upfront payment. They stopped advertising locally. They stopped focusing on the team. And the Raiders were never Los Angeles' team. And the conditions in a basically civil Southern California were more dangerous in the Coliseum than they were out on the street. And so L.A. would totally support a team, totally sell out. It's only 10 concert dates. The entertainment industry alone would support it. But we don't have the civic leadership. We don't have the single venue. We don't have the public foaming at the mouth. We don't have press that's supportive. We lack all the requisites now that we've lost a team to get one back.
Thank you for using that phrase, mischaracterization, rather than lie.
No, it's fine. The truth is, there was less attendance at the end, but it had a cause.
Yeah. Lee, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Good luck with the book. It's called The Agent, My 40-Year Career, Making Deals and Changing the Game. Lee Steinberg, great to talk to you again.
My pleasure.